Now, I want to introduce Nicholas Cullinan, my colleague from Tate, who also was extremely important in the conception of this event. We were working closely together and bringing our ideas about the content of this, what we wanted for this symposium to be. So I want to thank Nicholas for being a great companion in this venture, and also tell you more about him. He's curator of international modern arts here at Tate Modern, where he worked on similar exhibitions, including Duchamp and Ray Picavia, Cy Twombly, Pop Life, and is preparing the next Unilever series exhibition at the Tevan Hall with artist Tacita Dean. He's contributed to a number of publications, and also it's important to say that he worked at the Museum of Modern Art New York and the Guggenheim Museums in New York, Bilbao, and Venice. He's preparing a book on Robert Rauschenberg, which will be very exciting, and also a monograph on Cy Twombly for Phaidon. So without further ado, I want to introduce my colleague Nicholas Cullinan.
Okay, thanks everyone, and this is the final session of a long day. As the title indicates, what we wanted to do with the final session was to really shift the focus from the mind to the body, or the tension between the two. And so what I wanted to do just to introduce this session was to look at three case studies of from the recent few years. And it seems that there's been a proliferation of queer rereadings of conceptual art from the last sort of 5 years, which question its aesthetic of bureaucracy, its taxonomies, and systems of classification. So, of course, foremost among these is Francesco Vezzoli's The Bruce Nauman Trilogy from 2006, with its tongue-in-cheek homage to conceptual heartthrob Bruce Nauman. So here you see an installation shot, including the film, where a male porn star was the sort of doppelganger for Bruce Nauman, and then these other aspects of the installation. So this just sort of sets up this rather queer reading. And, of course, this is a reference to Bruce Nauman's seminal 1969 film Bouncing Balls. I think also noteworthy in this context is the work of the Berlin-based artist Henrik Olsen. And perhaps the first thing that I thought about with his work is actually his writings. So in 2006, he published an essay called Pre-Post Speaking Backwards, which cast a queer eye over some of the most staunchly heterosexual holy cows of conceptualism. So, for example, Olsen charted a history of London's invisible homosexual subcultures from the 19th century, and then mapped these onto modes of behavior, onto Vito Conti's work, for example, untitled Project for Pier 17 from 1971, transposing a Conti's recorded confessions whispered to passers-by at an abandoned pier into an act of cruising. And here you see Olsen's work, the installation, which riffs off, of course, Abby Warburg's Memescene Atlas, which basically charted this history of invisible sort of queer representations throughout art history. So this thing about visibility and invisibility is perhaps worth returning to, both in Sarah's paper and as we open it up for discussion. And then also, these are Olsen's works, which obviously refer to minimalist works, such as Solowitz's Structures, and a recent project that he's been working on about the mathematician Alan Turing, who was a codebreaker and, of course, ultimately was sort of persecuted for his homosexuality. And then the final example I just want to flag up, the final of the three, is Jonathan Horowitz's show, which is on at Sadie Cole's right now, which is not to be missed, which revisits the Holocaust Museum in Washington and the installations by artists including Ellsworth Kelly. So here you see Ellsworth Kelly's white triangle turned into a kind of flaming pink emblem of homosexuality, and other artists such as Richard Serra, Joel Shapiro, et cetera. So I just wanted to kind of bring it into the contemporary realm with these examples. Sadly, we're not going to be brought into the contemporary as much as we might have. Elena Filipovich was going to speak about her project with Felix Gonzalez Torres, where three artists, including Jan Vo, Tino Segal and Carol Bove have curated his work, but Eleanor has another mind-body problem. She's not well, so she can't be here. But Sarah Wilson is here, very much in mind and in body, and we'll be speaking today about two artists, so Robert Morris and Michelle Journiac, which I think sets up a very interesting set of tensions. Sarah was introduced last night, so I'm not going to repeat the introduction, apart from saying that it was Sarah that really brought the idea for this project to Tate, so we're really indebted to her for working with us over the last year. And I should just say that some of the things she'll be talking about today will feature in a forthcoming publication, which is called The Visual World of French Theory Interventions. So without further ado, I'll hand over to Sarah Wilson. Thank you.
Manfully. We're just waiting for some men to pop on the screen, not that one. Can you? Yes, yes, yes. So here are two beautiful bodies, the bodies of Robert Morris on the left and Michel Journiac on the right. Michel Journiac on the right, peeping through a little door, and Robert Morris looking very fetching on the left, about 1963. I think if you have any idea of their oeuvre, or at least Robert Morris's oeuvre, you will concede that he has a mind. And my comparison today, which of course has never been made before, but I found immensely interesting and provocative after it, as it were, came to mind when Nick proposed that I should talk about Journiac, is full of very surprises, but it's a study of the context, if you like, an expanded context of conceptual art itself in terms of proximity and difference, in fact, of synchronicity, but divided by the Atlantic, and at times not even divided by the Atlantic. It was actually the pragmatic philosopher John Dewey, in a text called Love and Chance in 1891, who talked about the preponderance at that moment of simultaneous discoveries, the planets around Uranus, kinetic theories of gases, natural selection, and the convergence and differences between these two artists is what I'm going to talk about. Now, why the mind-body problem? Why did this spring to mind? Because, in fact, I visited the Robert Morris retrospective where his works wound round the Guggenheim in 1994, and his late works were so disturbing that, foolishly, I didn't buy the absolutely splendid catalogue, which is a kind of masterpiece of American art history, involving, of course, Rosalind Krauss, Annette Michelson, W.T.J. Mitchell, and the Robert Morris expert, Morris Berger, among others. But it's very interesting the way that it seems to be embarrassed by the range of work it has to talk about, in particular these late hydrical reliefs with huge black frames full of skulls and things that Annette Michelson is fortunately able to compare with Rodin's Gates of Hell. I'm not going to really talk about those. What comes over is this immense embrace of Morris's early work and the intellectual Morris, the amazing way in which his reading of Wittgenstein links up with parodies that he uses in his own texts of Samuel Beckett parodying Wittgenstein in Watt, and so on and so forth. And of course, you'll notice that the little bar across the middle of the catalogue goes right across a very important area. Because this, in fact, is Robert Morris's so-called eye box of 1962. What, in fact, is the mind-body problem? The mind-body problem is one of the absolute classics of philosophy departments. It's one of the great chestnuts, if you like, if you look at the history of philosophy, which can involve, for example, the different relationships between all these various theories. There are substance dualists who related to the history of Cartesianism. They're reductive materialists who come out of the philosophy of Feuerbach. They're immaterialists who come out of Berkeley, who believe the world doesn't exist at all. They're epiphenomenalists. And in this very interesting book I found of 1966, a survey of the mind-body problem, written by a Dutchman, Van Dersen, but published in Oxford in 66, so it comes hot off the press, straight into that Oxford-based art and language group. There are two more chapters. One is called Bodiliness, which is really about Merleau-Ponty and the idea of incorporation. And the final chapter is called The Elusive Eye, as in the I here, which moves from Wittgenstein and the whole idea of the universe as a set of language games to other philosophical concepts around the I, which are picked up again, for example, by Annette Michelson when she talks about I in linguistics as a shifter in the Robert Morris catalogue. And one of the big problems about the mind-body problem is it's all very well if you look at what is the relationship between the mind and body, but the problem is the relationship through time. Are we going to go for a psychological continuity theory of personal identity or an essentially diachronic view of the mind, or just leave it on this kind of philosophical mind-body plateau? It's, of course, the diachronic evolution through time of Robert Morris, which tormented his curators. So what do we get in this I box that we don't get in the cover of the catalogue? Of course, we get Robert Morris's genitals and the fact that the white male, what did we say this morning, the white boy NATO philosophical subject who is so prevalent in conceptual art is in fact a kind of autochthonous, not of woman born, philosophical subject. And of course, an American philosophical subject is deeply impregnated with Anglo-American empiricism and pragmatism. And to go back to one of the great early American pragmatists, it's remarkable how Dewey, again, in 1907, in What Pragmatism Means by Practical, actually gives you the most eloquent description of Robert Morris's own move from, as it were, task performance to the sculptures he called primary structures. I'll show you these in a second. Listen to this fantastic quote from What Pragmatism Means to Be Practical. It involves unreserved frankness, lucid imagination, and the capacity to put into an English which projects ideas as if bodily into space. They are solid things to walk around and survey from different sides. So we have this American mindset, so different from the continental mindset, which I'm going to contrast with the Robert Morris problem by moving to Michel Journiac's, as it were, eye box. Now, this is a completely different thing. This is his Portable Altar of 1969, a deeply autobiographical work, as he trained in a Catholic seminary. He was brought up in a non-religious family, of quite a poor, lower-middle-class family in Paris, but he went to the Grand Theological Institute and took a degree in not only theology, but medieval scholasticism. He then actually trained and became qualified as a priest. And here, but of course he had a big crisis because just around a very, very important time in his life, he suddenly realized that he had homosexual urges which were not allowed, ostensibly, the ostensoire element being part of the point of my talk, ostensibly by the Catholic Church. And in this autobiographical eye box, you have a host, a chalice, a bodily wound, a hand doing something, and with these trousers hanging on the wall, the idea of unfrocking. Because, of course, when he renounced the church, he became an unfrocked priest. But the contrast between these two, if you like, eye boxes, brings up an enormous divide. It's not just the divide between analytical and continental philosophy, but this is, of course, a big issue. The mindset of people in Paris who were very, very well acquainted with conceptual art and artists, as I'll show in a second, was a different mindset from the mindset in America. The rendezvous manqué, if you like, began in 1958 when there was the first conference of analytical philosophy in Paris, in outside Paris, which tried to bring together the great minds from Oxford, Austin, Hare, and so forth, together with the sort of Hegelian Jean Rawl and Merleau-Ponty and Lucien Goldman, the man who you might acquaint with the Nouveau Roman. And it was such a disaster, although it was couched with extreme academic politeness, as you can imagine, that at the end, Merleau-Ponty apparently said, "But at least we have the same programme." And the Oxfordians replied, "I hope not." So obviously, this was a terrible disaster, which, as you know, has kind of cleaved the world, not only of philosophy, but of art history ever since, and is one of my particular interests. The other thing I should say, to let a cat out of the bag, is that the 1966 book I've mentioned called The Mind-Body Problem, that's actually its subtitle. The actual title of the book is Body, Soul and Spirit, The Mind-Body Problem. And actually, there's a very interesting chapter which precedes the I, Wittgenstein I chapter, which is about body, soul, and spirit in the Bible. It makes the point that the terminology of the Bible, and we're talking, of course, about a Catholic country where Mass is said every day to millions of its citizens, where children are taught the catechism and so forth, is related to translations from words with very, very deep, not only Hebrew, but Greek roots, where, for example, the word for soul, nephesh, I pronounce these incorrectly, of course, where the word for soul means breath, where the soul is hungry and yearns for food from God, where all flesh is grass, and so forth. Once you get to the etymological level, and you know that at this time in Paris, everyone is very, very interested in etymology, the mind-body problem takes on a different problematic, if you like. And of course, there is the religious issue too, which of course is the other big philosophical problem about belief in God or non-belief. And of course, God has escaped from this eye box. It is either full or empty of God, depending on the spectator's position or the way you read it. So Journiac too involved naked bodies in his very earliest pieces. This is Piège pour un voyeur, Trap for a voyeur, in which very Dan Flavin-like, obviously neon tubes make a cage in which very provocatively for France in 1969, he had a body who actually sees more of the audience looking out than the audience blinded by the neon can see looking in. However, of course, you can see that in his, and of course, Journiac, like Morris, is involved in performative practice at this moment. And they are, of course, essential Duchampians, both of them. On the left, you have, of course, Duchamp's playing Adam and Eve still with Eva Perlmutter that Robert Morris interrogated him about. I can't remember what he actually asked him about, but he actually asked Duchamp about this piece and Duchamp's performance. And on the right, you have one of Michel Journiac's other traps of 1969, in which the whole point, of course, is people can change gender. It's not actually just to do with poking your head through the thing and having your photograph and making your body better or worse according to your own attributes. I just want to catch up with where I'm supposed to be at this second. So the interesting thing is, was there actually a connection between the two? You see here that at almost, not quite exactly the same moment, on the left is Morris's Duchamp piece called Fountain. On the right is Michel Journiac's washing exhibition, La Lessive, 1969. Obviously, you can see that Journiac is a little bit more Baroque than Morris, of course, where all the good people were washed up and hang on the washing line. That defrocking idea is still there. That stripping naked idea is still there. But the artists he didn't like were put into the waste paper basket and considered as kind of dirty and soiled. La souillure being a very interesting word relating to sin, of course, in France. And when we get to Morris's own sort of play with Duchamp, something very interesting and much more kind of classically conceptual happens. And I think it's important to show these three pieces and see them as both conceptual pieces and very Duchampian. On the left is his card file of 1963, which is a simple, if you like, ready-made card file, although the cards say various complex and difficult and interesting things. In the middle is his box with a sound of its own making, which has got a 3.5-hour soundtrack in of him actually making the box on the top. And I particularly like this early image, which I believe is from the Tate 1971 catalogue, because it shows the relationship of the box to its pedestal and this strange human-sized sculpture that was Morris's specific... his speciality. He's very, very interested in Duchamp and the repressed sexual energy of the pedestal. If you read his thesis, he wrote on, on Brancusi. If you read his thesis, he wrote on Brancusi in 1966. And here is his take, if you like, his mind-body take on Duchamp's three standard stoppages, where instead of Duchamp, as you know, throwing three meter pieces of string onto the floor and doing curvy rulers, he's actually made a self-portrait of his own encephalogram his brain wiggles, as it were, as a form of very, very disembodied measurement, but something highly personalized. So, in fact, Robert Morris did go to Paris in 1968. I don't know if he did himself, but his work certainly went to Paris on his behalf. In the Elena Sonnabend Gallery, which was trying to dominate and crush the art scene in conjunction with Leo Castelli in New York by having absolutely major shows of all the American great artists. And so it was obviously a focus of attention that indeed Journiac might have gone to. But in fact, it was only the primary structures works that were on display. These kind of very, very severe sculptures. However, by 69, Journiac is already engaged, obviously quite spontaneously, although obviously linked up with the spirit of the age, in very interesting installation and conceptual practices. My vision of Journiac in this lecture is highly tailored, I might add, to give you a more, to emphasize the conceptual relationships he had. This is the Salon des Arts at the Paris Musée de la Ville de Paris in 1969, very, very early, where you see that he's actually set up his neon lights with his name as a kind of a shop, like what they were talking about with the kind of ideal home exhibitions, the Salon des Arts Ménagers. So he's actually imitating a sort of ideal home exhibition within the gallery very early. And if you look at the thing on the bottom, he's really into branding and self-branding long before Tate acquired its magic little sugar fizzles and so forth. So he's a very, very intelligent artist, involved with but not exclusively linked to any proto-conceptual pieces in Paris. And the next year, rather than a card file, he actually gets a kind of automatic distributor to, you put a coin in the slot and you get a work of art out of it. Because obviously there's an economic critique about the art world, the art market, the product and what you get implicit in his work. There's also, of course, the presence of these artists in Paris. And here you can see by April 1970, there was a happening involving Lawrence Wiener, Taroni, who's the close partner of Buren, who's there, Robert Ryman, Ed Rusha, On Kawara, Douglas Hubert Gilberton, George Robert Barry, Marcel Brutus, basically everyone comes to Paris. As you know, all good Americans go to Paris, even at this time in 1970. And so whereas Seth's thing this morning was that everything was all over the world, but people were traveling to more exotic places, there was a very important conceptual art coming and going in Paris, a very important critic whose name is down there, François Pluchart. And Pluchart takes the credit for inventing this thing called art corporel, and he's had a very important journal with a lot of conceptual art and body art in it cohabiting called Artitudes. But you'll see that after the evening after this big schmoozerama in Paris, everybody went to François Pluchart's apartment and Michel Journiac signed checks, a la Duchamp, of course, in between the dates one associates below them with Robert Morris's check-signing enterprise. What's very interesting, Robert Morris started doing a kind of check project with the Whitney that was refused. He wanted to take some money from the Whitney, this is very interesting, invest it on the European art market and bring them back the profit, which they refused to do. Later on, he expanded this project. That was 69, in 73. So you can see how there's this very strange relationship, whereas He at the bottom is into real estate and selling artwork. Journiac is actually very delighted at the transubstantiation of a check into liquid money. That's all he's doing with his check signing. But obviously the check brings up the same kind of associations. Wait a second. So another exhibition that you'll find very amusing, and I put the Daniel Buren parody in on the left, especially for Daniel, is his parody of a collection of 1971, where he parodied lots and lots of contemporary artists. And of course, this idea of humour and irony is something we had very much in the last film, but possibly not in all presentations. But obviously, you know, there were people who were looking at Daniel Buren's stripes and reframing him in the most hideous golden frames they possibly could deliberately to annoy him, and also doing this with Rauschenberg, which brings one, of course, to the fact that it's in, obviously, as I say, Journiac is gay, having interesting discussions about this. This is the beginning of a gay milieu in Paris where, obviously, Jean Genet is a flagship, but all sorts of groups are getting together. I've written about this in other places, but it's the moment I wanted to say, if you think of 66, the Oxford Mind Body publication, 66 is Lacan's writings published, his écrit in Paris, and it's the round about this time that Derrida starts using the word phallogocentrisme, which we can call logophallocentrism if we want to. To get back then to the essence of my comparison, on the left is then iBox, Robert Morris's iBox. On the right is Michel Journiac's male art piece, if you want to call it that, or conceptual art. It was also pasted as a poster in galleries in 1970, called Homage to Freud, a critical constat, like a statement, of a transvestite mythology. And what he does is he dresses up. He photographs his father top left, his mother bottom left, and dresses up as his father top left and up as his mother bottom left. Now, what this is saying, whether or not we hide the naughty bits of Robert Morris, is that the individual, the body-mind, is actually genetically linked to the idea of, to the parents who've created him. Obviously, it's satirical and amusing at the same time. And that there is a big nature-nurture problem. We aren't just the philosophical thinking body or the mind which decides to do a task performance. There's the whole problem that we drag around with us of Freud. In fact, one of the philosophers I read in my homework for this presentation said the whole of Freud's oeuvre is because he failed to solve the mind-body problem adequately, and he came up with a hybrid solution which does not bear philosophical scrutiny. So obviously this is what Journiac's homage is saying, which you'll see what's very important and interesting is he's using the word travesti. He says Robert Journiac travesti en Robert Journiac. Robert Journiac travesti into Robert Journiac. Michel Journiac travesti en Robert Journiac. René Journiac, his mother's called René, travesti en René Journiac. And Michel Journiac travesti en René Journiac. The interesting thing about the word travesti in French is that it's not just linked to the word transvestite, but the word travesty. It's not making a point about transvestism so much as travesty. And in terms of Boris's notion of self-design, which haunts so many people, you'll see that at the very top, René, the father, Robert Journiac himself, is a travesty of Robert Journiac. He's always already travestying himself. René Journiac down there is always already doing her Twin Set and Pearls René Journiac number. So there's the problem of the poor bare forked animal prior to nature and nurture, this little thing that is born, and then the travestissement that takes place as we are cultured. Of course, one thinks, and obviously Michel Journiac was a feminist, of Simone de Beauvoir, one is not born, but one becomes a woman. He's also saying, I thought of Lady Di, there are three people in this marriage. There are four people in this person. There's one person in Robert Morris, of course, but there are four people in Michel Journiac. So that's making you think a little bit further out of the box, one could say, about this sort of affair. Now, of course, Morris himself was also a great one for dressing up. Surprise, surprise. This is Robert Morris dressed up for a strange performance called Arizona as early as 1963. But more interestingly, he also used the notion of transvestism in his own performance pieces. This is a very famous and classic and very sexy performance piece called Waterman's Switch of 1975, where I love the way that the MoMA catalogue says, clad only in oil, clad in oil. He schmoozes to music and sound, very complex, I can't describe, along these minimalist sculptural pieces, followed by this dancer, Lucinda Child, who for some strange reason is unwinding a ball of twine in her transvestite outfit. So he's already, if you like, by using these, you know, this third person challenging these straight gender divides that he, you know, that were there in his early work, that was the big problem for Marcel Duchamp. I mean, Marcel Duchamp's bachelors are defined by their absence, their pain of separation. It goes right back to Plato and the Androgyne, I think. So here we are with Robert Morris becoming a little bit more provocative in certain ways. And of course, you get to this kind of switching between France and between France and America at this funny moment of 1975. This is when Journiac himself does an amazing series called Incest, where he dresses up in various relationships where he's actually studying this, this taboo subject. Incidentally, in his very fetching black rubber Mac at the top, as a lover, making love to his fils garçon amant, to his son, boy, lover, with this jealous other Journiac looking on. He actually uses this same leather jacket in a film made by Guy Hockenguem, who is now very, very famous in America as kind of the French queer theorist, which was called Race d'Ep. Race d'Ep was a pun on race de pédéraste. It's a pun on pederast, and it's like a whole series, a whole film about the history of pederasty, in which he plays a Nazi officer bursting into Kraft Ebbing's bureau to close it down in the 1930s in the same Mac, which is very fortunate for me because I have to have encounters in each of the chapters of the book I'm writing. So he took transvestism to new levels in his series called 24 Hours in the Life of an Ordinary Woman. I'm afraid to say this is the only woman apart from me in my talk. It was actually shown, we were talking about white boxes and black boxes last night, all the daytime fantasies and the actually boring daytime life of this poor woman who has to get up, make her husband's breakfast, clock in at the factory, go and buy Tampax secretly at 11 o'clock, cook her husband's thing, watch him reading the newspaper in bed. That's all downstairs. And her fantasies of being swept away on a bicycle by a beautiful man and various other things are upstairs in the dark. So that two-tier installation, which was the sort of thing that was alternating with more conceptual, I mean, less figurative installations, if you like, was typical, I think, and I hope that, Daniel Buren was extensively involved in this. He knows very well that amazing milieu of the Paris of 1970s with galleries not only like Stadler, but in particular Templon, which produced Catherine Millet, whom I'll talk about in a second, and the Galerie Yvon Lambert. So we get to this big surprise that really threw the people at MoMA, and I'm sure the moment where Thomas Krenz thought, am I going to continue with writing Robert Morris's catalogue raisonné or not? Because suddenly this very, very complex voice piece, very, very complex indeed, in the Leo Castelli Gallery with eight soundtracks, some of which were deliberately incomprehensible, only two at once, one in a drone, lasting for 3 hours on a loop, of course, were played, but the poster was this extraordinary SM. This is, you know, obviously Robert Morris travesti en SM with chains, clanking neck pieces, this military helmet. But something very interesting is happening here, because remember, we've talked a little bit about the Vietnam context. Obviously, it's also the sort of Dr. Strangelove, mad nuclear Cold War masculinities creating the Cuban Missile Crisis moment. And as we get through to the 70s, something interesting happens, even in terms of the popular philosophy going around in New York. Because obviously, as well as the Anglo-American pragmatism and everything I've been quoting, and the idea of linguistic tautologies, so important for conceptual art, you have the kind of Frankfurt School making, I was going to use the term moiré, I'm obviously thinking too much in French, but the Frankfurt School comes in and kind of spoils, makes ripples on this surface. And you move, if you like, from Herbert Marcuse's Eros and Civilization at the beginning of the 60s into his idea of repressive tolerance in 65, and by 72, counter-revolution and revolt. And then you get the oil crisis. Before this piece, you know, 73-5, everything is suddenly breaking up. And one of the voices that comes in to what was once upon a time in his voice pieces, a kind of Molloy, Beckett, Watt, circular linguistic drone, into this drone, you get him performing or using performers to quote Ernest Krepelin's text on senile dementia of 1919, and his text on manic depression and paranoia. So you're actually getting into this. This is, again, of course, the moment of this anti-psychiatry. You're getting into these texts in the empty, bare gallery, one must emphasize, and with this kind of drawing to go with them that, of course, people collecting conceptual art absolutely love putting on walls, you're getting the sounds of dementia, of manic depression, and so forth. Which is obviously why I find Morris very, very intriguing. So politics, and just to say that as things become worse, very, very rapidly, the work of Journiac spreads out from spreads out of the gallery and into political issues. One thing that's very interesting to compare with Daniel Buren's Affiche Sauvage, and remember, 68 is not only the moment of his wild posters, as they were called, but the moment of his contract, is the just later on, comes in 2 years later, comes Beckett's Referendum, where he actually parodies the whole democratic process by having an election about himself in the Galerie Templon, with, of course, the proper bulletins and proper votes and proper vote counters. Again, the critic Catherine Millet counting the votes. Fake results, just as they had in Eastern Europe, of course, saying 25 million people voted. There was 1 million spoiled ballots, and the whole thing was unanimously carried by 24 million people versus the real results. Obviously, the situation in Paris was in a kind of aftermath, melancholic post 68 situation that was building up by 74 to the right-wing government after de Gaulle. And of course, in 77, what I found astonishing is that they were still guillotining people in 1977. This piece that Journiac makes about a guillotine, which is, if you like, a passage between the conceptual work and the sculpture and the body, as I'll show you, was made in 1971. Obviously, the big debate, which is very well known in France, and focuses around the figure of Robert Badinter, they only abolished capital punishment in 1981. So this is the very, very year of the Pompidou Center's Paris, New York. They're carrying out jolly guillotines. Michel Journiac is in the 1971, I don't know if this is photo 71 or 77, is actually making a Stations of the Cross of the people who are being guillotined. You see he's got his signing on, you have your last mass, then you have your last cigarette, then you meet the executioner, and that's as far as the stages go. But at the bottom of that piece, you can't see it, at the bottom of that trajectory, just where we're standing is this. And this is called constat d'une exécution capitale. This is the body that's left, the blood and the guts that are placed by Journiac at the end of that guillotine piece. And of course, with that, almost coterminously, he does these very small works on paper with type, one of the ways one can, notionally speaking, identify conceptual art. And it says, the body of the crime is always the body of the poor. Here, if you like, we're pulled back into the situation of the Catholicism of his work and the one major piece, which I'm now going to speak about, which I didn't bring in at the beginning. Because, of course, one of the things Journiac does, which is most celebrated and most famous, is to actually hold a mass, a proper mass in Latin, which he was qualified to do, in the Galerie Templon, with a host made of his own blood. This is obviously a pre-AIDS moment. He actually, instead of having a host, he makes a blood pudding out of his own blood, so that when he says, this is my body, he is actually giving people, in this Christ-like way, part of his body. Everyone was apparently very hushed. It was a very strange event. It's also on video. Pierre Restany, the great art critic, was one of the participants. And this brings up a very interesting issue, of course, the issue of presence, the issue of belief, and the divide between ideas of consubstantiation, the bread actually turning into the body of Christ, or the bread merely being a symbol. Here he is officiating with somebody, and I want to talk just at this moment about the distinctions of the sacred I found very useful in the writings of Jean-Luc Nancy. At the very beginning, it's typical of the intellectualism of French exhibition catalogues. There's been one big retrospective exhibition of Journiac in Strasbourg. On the first page, of course, the curator Fabrice Ergot mentions Jean-Luc Nancy's book Corpus, which was written during Journiac's lifetime in 1992. And he talks about the meanings and the disturbing negative meanings of this moment of saying, this is my body. Because Journiac said, of course, at this moment, hoc est enim corpus meam. The body of God is here. He talks about the real consecration or the symbolic consecration. He also says, this is Nancy, it is almost the most visible repetition of an obstinate or sublimated paganism. The repetition par excellence to the point of obsession, to the point where this is my body becomes the butt of jokes. These ritual words have been pronounced ceaselessly by millions of officiants in millions of sites. And he sees the sites in which this is my body is enacted. He enumerates the variations of it. He sees those sites as being contained, for example, in the expression ergo sum, the nude in painting, Nietzsche's madness, Madame Bovary, the voice of the castrato or the soprano, the idea of the thinking reed, the roseau pensant, which was one of Descartes' tropes, and the hysteric. He gives a huge list. So that the idea of this problem of embodiment and saying, this is my body, is something where Journiac is actually putting that notion into the art gallery. On the other hand, to turn to somebody else who I'm sure you find very apposite at the moment and who is celebrated at the Royal College of Art on the 17th of March. This is Agamben's text Apparatus, around which there was a whole year working at the Royal College. So it's a very topical text for us, his What is an Apparatus of 2006. He talks about what profanation really means, because obviously Journiac is inviting a sacred moment on the one hand, and on the other hand, he's enacting a very enormous act of blasphemy or profanation. He talks, Agamben, about profanation of objects that had belonged to the gods, that were sacred and hence removed from trading, from trade, and says that sacrilegious are the acts which violated or transgressed the special unavailability of these objects. So by bringing the chalice, by bringing the host, by bringing the blood, by bringing his own body turned into a host into the art gallery, he's sort of asking a question about whether he has desacralized these objects and turned them into profane objects or not. This is, of course, all framed institutionally within a kind of Foucauldian framework as well at the same time. So I'd like to show how this very strange moment is something which Robert Morris also intimates. I'm coming to a kind of pause before a conclusion. This is the host which Journiac makes, if you like, a conceptual art piece of by, it says at the bottom, proposition for the ritual obliteration of an anthropophagic rite, eating man. And it's very interesting to compare that in terms of this idea of withdrawal of the projective identification of the spectator and the spectator's thoughts and feelings to Morris's earlier piece called Statement of Aesthetic Withdrawal, Litanies. On the left is this work he gave to Philip Johnson and decided to sell to him at the moment. It's got some keys on it at the bottom. It's a lead piece. And on the right, because Johnson didn't pay him, he said, OK, I'm going to take all the aesthetic quality out of this, and made this piece, which actually says on the right, in this, again, framed in lead, I, Robert Morris, hereby withdraw from the said construction all aesthetic quality and content, and declare that from the date hereof, this construction has no such quality and content. So these two trajectories have these very, very interesting parallels. And what I found almost unbelievable was the way that they both end up doing gold skeletons in slightly different ways. On the one hand, as early as 1972, Journiac, who worked a lot not only with the idea of the body and the body as contract, this extended to a lot of work with transvestites and prostitutes, which I'm not going to show you, made this contract for a cadaver, if you like, for a body. Obviously, the word corpse is contained in corps, body in French, where you can have three ways of donating your body to him. In fact, Mae West wanted to have her body, in theory, gilded by Journiac. I'm not showing you this at the moment. And you ended up with this golden object. In some ways, it's a very, very 70s piece. There's a whole kind of 70s, late 70s flavor of what's going on here, which is also completely written out of art history or the mind-body problem catalogue. And this is Journiac's piece of 1980 called First Study for a View from the Corner of Orion. Now, it's a huge piece. It's a huge gilded piece with this skeleton in the middle of it. And on revisiting it, all the MoMA Guggenheim catalogue says is it's about curved mirrors and space-age technology. Obviously, art itself at this moment has moved into a strange Baroque period, a kind of vanitas that precedes, a vanitas era that certainly precedes the moment of AIDS, which is going to embrace Journiac a little bit later. And that funny 70s moment, which causes so much disquiet, has still not properly been written about. But I want to think now, to move, if you like, from bathos, because I find both these works very, very full of bathos, to pathos. Just as contemporary installation structure our perception of the frame of the artwork and its spectators, so what has been called the danger of pathos for a retrospective reading is, I contend, entirely viable when we come to the very, very straight things of conceptual art. Moreover, if we look at this right from the very beginning, when Morris himself was doing his eye box, there was a way in which he was always already thinking about the box not simply as a piece of Duchampian measurement or a little peekaboo wardrobe, but as a coffin. This piece is called Untitled Rough Tombstone, also from 1969. It makes me also think about Boris's favorite metaphor of the art historian's work as the Egyptologist interviewing the mummy. Although I think in this case it's inasmuch as Robert Morris was a very, very keen young Egyptologist when he was a boy, I think it might be the other way round, but also give us a very interesting, much more long durée explanation for some of these pure, notionally pure conceptual works. And of course, when he actually puts mirrors on the side of those boxes, that repetition of his body is structured to infinity. Any notion of mind is also fragmented to infinity. So that problem of the mind-body being more complex, more death-ridden, more less full of Cartesian certainty is there at the very, very beginning of his work. And what about conceptual art itself as a kind of vanitas? Because if we look at his card file piece now, everything about it is obsolete, it's yellowed. Once upon a time, it was obviously the paradigm of a knowledge system. It's full of charts, of graphs, and so forth. But even to go back to Boris yesterday, the hardware as well as the software is obsolete. The pages are yellowed. The propositions inside the pages, of course, are not yellowed. But if we look back to that moment and think of what it says on one of these cards, considerations, futures, locations, responses, and so forth, all these as well seem slightly sad to me. To conclude, Morris himself, of course, made AIDS-related works. This is a work for, this is a work for an architect, thinker, friend of his called Alan Buchsbaum of 1987. Strangely enough, in terms of Journiac, somebody who made a plasticized hassock. I don't understand that. And Journiac himself, very, very early, remember Foucault died of AIDS in 1984. In 1983, Journiac did a performance piece in which he branded the pink triangle from the Nazi camps onto his arm. This was a motif and a performance that he would repeat through the 80s into the early 90s, and at the same time involve a lot of works with his blood. I've shown you the early pieces involved with money, but now he moved to putting pieces of his own blood on 100-franc notes, on the pages of poems, and so forth. I can't go through all of those things, but I want to end with this thought, because I did, of course, think when I made my presentation that we were moving straight on to Felix González Torres. What's interesting is that this piece by Torres actually precedes the last works by Journiac. They're contemporaries. Journiac died, in fact, of cancer in 1995, just after I discovered his work in the exhibition Féminin Masculin. And here with this Polaroid, you see a mourning piece with the names of his friends who have died and a skull. And he says here, on continue, à bientôt, j'espère. We'll go on, see you soon, Journiac. Of course, there's an amazing pathos. Well, I mean, what I want to say is, of course, that this work by Torres at the top that is so famous, it's called Perfect Lovers. It has all the ideas of synchronicity, non-synchronicity, entropy, the impossible separation of two people, is, of course, very, very clever because it's a deliberate renvoi to a Three Clocks piece by Kossuth. This piece below, in many ways, is not so clever, but I hope you can see that it's got a different kind of imbrication in it, a different kind of mind-body problem. So my last little paragraph, it thinks about what Seth said this morning in two quotes he gave from Robert Barry. One was about Robert Barry telling a secret. I thought, what could be mind-body problem involved in telling a secret? I was told on good authority this morning that we've come closer to the end of the world. Certainly, I've come closer to the end of my world. I would even hazard from an objective or an entirely solipsistic point of view that conceptualism, once pure, but synchronically as well as diachronically expanded to both global both globally and through time, is also coming closer to its end in the world. And as Robert Barry said, trust me. Thank you.
I want to ask Sarah a couple of questions, then we'll open it up to the audience to take questions about Sarah's paper in particular, and then perhaps we could also open it up further for any questions, any residual remaining questions about the day to any of the speakers. So to begin, Sarah, I was struck by the set of sort of binary opposites that were established by your paper, either intentionally or unintentionally, so between obviously mind-body, queer and straight, Europe and America, center and periphery, objective, subjective, et cetera, et cetera. Was this, do you think this is a productive way to think about this historical moment, i.e. the 1970s, and the kind of tail end of conceptualism?
Well, it depends. It depends, of course, when the tail end starts. But of course, when I showed Homage to Freud, the whole thing is everything is imbricated in everything else. The fact that they have this conference about the problem of philosophy when they realise there are these two schools, even in 1958, shows that there's that on the cards. The fact that people were studying professional philosophy and then, you know, running off to get married in Catholic churches and either believing or disbelieving what they say is something where there's a whole issue at stake. And what I did want to say, because nobody made this point about Latin America, is the Catholicism business is very, very important. It's very important in terms of women's liberation, because obviously women were not allowed to practice contraception. And there was a difference between liberated Anglo-Saxon feminists, the very, very privileged people and intellectually liberated and socially privileged people in Paris who were able at first to take the pill, and the people in Poland, precisely, and in Latin America, where women were caught in a catch-22, which we may not bother to think about nowadays, but in fact, it was a very, very serious form of imprisonment in some ways at a moment when everything else was expanding. So with very, very mind-body important consequences, of course. So you asked me about dualism. I mean, this is the way that philosophy likes to frame the mind-body problem. I didn't invent it. I wouldn't have. I think I'm much. Actually, this is why I think that the chapter on the Bible in this mind-body problem book is so interesting. Not only have we all been brought up with certain of those concepts and certain of those words, but it seems even in the imponderability of a word being soul and breath, more sophisticated than the anxious dualisms that philosophers subsequently installed. And what's more, the beginning of it is very charming because it's all about how philosophers are very imprecise. And Plato divides the soul from the body, but then says the body is the picture of the soul. And we all know what it's like to walk around, even if philosophers, when they're writing or expatiating, pretend they're separated from what they're saying. So my position is clear, it's non-dualist, but I was talking about all the bifurcations at the time. Obviously, one could talk endlessly about all the other philosophers and all the other things that were happening at the time and what people read. I mean, we have Michel Journiac's library, fortunately, under the floorboards of the house in which most of his work is kept. So we know what he read.
I wanted to also link this back to the discussion this morning after the first session, where Boris talked about the idea of visibility and how one might accrue that in some way by just seizing it. And what seemed interesting about this session in your paper is the idea that there might be another term for that. There might be some kind of slippage. So, for example, the role of drag, where you're visible but in some other guise. And I wonder if that's a kind of suggestive.
Well, I think that there is a philosophical proposition in his idea of travestissement. Mm-hmm. And when he does very OTT things and uses real-life prostitutes as ready-mades, if you like, or as travestis per se, or when he... what's interesting is I've used his 24 heures as a critique of Pierre Bourdieu at the time. Pierre Bourdieu is doing this sociology. And in this moment when people are talking more and more about desire, the actual, you know, lower class woman's lot going to the factory in a bourgeois marriage in some piddling little apartment somewhere is desperately miserable. And if you like, he's using the travesti piece as a kind of liberation theology to say, stop doing that. So that this business of the fluctuation of gender is not just a practice or a performance or a spectacle, it's actually a kind of symbolic proposition of self-liberation in some ways, however quaint and out of fashion that might seem now.
I think it might be also fruitful to address the criticism or the concern raised earlier about the lack of women, and particularly at this moment. And if you think about the 1970s, my understanding is that the sort of hegemony of, say, the Communist Party in many European countries was really eroded through the birth of women's liberation, gay rights, all of these things. And I wonder if you could say the same about conceptual art, that in the 1970s it really fails to perhaps respond enthusiastically to those developments. I'm thinking about Robert Morris's famous photo piece, but also Linda Benglis's rather provocative posture with a dildo that was an art forum. So do you see this as in some way a kind of rupture, a schism?
Well, just to talk about the French situation, the thing that I think is most amazing in terms of invisibility is that Catherine Millet and people like Suzanne Paget, who then become the gurus of the art world, women, were at all those events. Mm. And then when it comes to the moment of the first proper retrospective of conceptual art, which is a brilliant idea held by Suzanne Paget in Paris, they write out the whole European and French adventure for some strange reason. This is the context in which Buchlow does his piece. Now, if we've looked with Fred Wilson at memory-based pieces, the aesthetic of, I mean, what's it called? The whatnot of administration. The
aesthetic of administration.
What's the first bit? From the something of something to the, I'm just having a brain failure.
Can anyone remember the title of that? Thank you.
Yes. Anyway, the aesthetic of administration in France was introduced by, notionally speaking, in terms of people's psyche and them all having to have identity cards, was introduced by the Nazis. Mm-hmm. And they thought, what a jolly good idea, and kept it on afterwards. That's why they all had identity cards long before us. Mm. And, I mean, the whole business of France's, of what is invisible in France and what it hasn't coped with, is enormous. And the aesthetic of administration is very, very much involved in it. So that there was Benjamin Buchlow's fantasy of an aesthetic of administration. Mm. But in France, especially, you saw in Daniel's piece, his Affiche Sauvage, one of the things said Yankee Nazi. That's to do with Vietnam, of course. Mm. But actually, the memory of the right being associated with the Nazis and what the Nazis did and the administration of people's lives. It's like the guillotine piece, except instead of seeing the plate of meat, everything has been disappeared. And the lateness of... So the point is, I haven't quite answered your question globally, because I think that some of the issues I'm talking about are a little bit more interesting to me than the sort of Linda Benglis thing. I think she's being a naughty girl and good for her. But I think
there's an important point which we probably will now open out to questions, but it's about the reception of conceptual art, which is entirely different from the historical moments, so from the 60s to the 70s. Mm, and of course... Had we had the final paper, we could have gone into the 80s and beyond. Mm. But this might be an opportune moment to open it to questions from the audience, if we have any. So put your hands up.
That was absolutely brilliant. But could you say what you mean at the end? Could you explicate what you meant when you said that conceptualism, you're coming to an end, conceptualism is coming to an end?
Well, I was just trying to talk about death. So firstly, I showed the fact that Morris was already thinking about coffins right from the word go. But secondly, somebody did, talking about the terrible tragedy that's happening at the moment, a Catholic person actually did actually say to me this morning, you know, we're nearer to the end of the world. And I was trying, I mean, this came up when I really saw how the difference between the colour filing card and the black and white image of the filing card. And I always think, and I was thinking what Boris said yesterday about people not being able to, about ordinary people not being able to accept collage in Cubist paintings, but being able to accept it in film. When Picasso made collages with yesterday's newspaper, you know, they were really in your face. And now they are all dark yellow and they look like very difficult Cubist works in museums. And so I think that and this is an interesting thing when you get to the way conceptual art moves in the oeuvre of somebody like Joseph Kossuth or Lawrence Wiener, where it's much straighter than in the work of somebody like Morris. There's a problem about the ageing process, because this is another thing, obviously, that philosophers don't want to think about. They like thinking about the mind-body problem, but they don't like thinking about this business. I mean, even the philosopher I read was talking about the diachronic personality through time. They don't like to think of the link, which of course, is it Beckett said, the body is the something that chains a dog to its vomit. I used to know my Beckett very, very well. We are actually, Yeats has a thing about an old tin can being dragged along. We are inevitably chained to our decaying bodies. And interestingly enough, even though it tries to escape its embodiment, it doesn't escape its language, of course, which is your thing, Boris, but even though it tries to escape its embodiment, the filing card is as touching as a yellowed Cubist collage. So all I was saying is that inasmuch as we're all not going to be discussing this in 100 years' time, there's a sense of mortality, even in the most embodied but rigorous conceptual art piece, which I take the liberty of interpreting with a degree of pathos, but in theory you're not supposed to do that.
We have another question over there.
I was wondering about, the phrase I keep thinking of listening to your talk was, you know, the personal is political, which is the feminist credo. Mm-hmm. It's the same moment. What about feminist conceptualists? They haven't come up yet. Hannah Wilkie, Mary Kelly. So here you have...
Precisely. I just do want to say I cooked this up with Nick, and Nick specifically asked me to do this paper. And so I did want to even preface it at the beginning, and I did mention yesterday in my introduction that at the moment there's a fantastic Susan Hiller exhibition on, and Bethan Hughes at the Whitechapel. And I'm particularly interested in this issue, but for various reasons I've had to suppress it. So all I can say is do go to Susan Hiller, and what a magnificent female conceptual artist she is, and her evolution, of course, through time, and what she's allowed in and what she's not allowed in is very interesting. And, you know, it's interesting to compare them generationally, because one could have thought that the work that's more like straight Duchamp parody would be earlier, and her expanding into extrasensory perception, something I haven't mentioned in the mind-body problem, which is to do with all sorts of things, would you think that was the later work, was the later person, the later artist? Mm. So it's a huge issue, and I'm afraid I'm not 100% responsible for it not being here. But I feel it.
One more question over there.
I would just love to hear a bit more about Jauniac's male artwork, and I thought it was interesting that you described his work as that piece that you showed as male art or conceptual piece, and sort of there's that conflation or link between male art and conceptualism. And then perhaps you could comment upon this discussion of the body within terms of the male art. And I think Clara mentioned the idea of the male artwork as proxy for the body, which could maybe lend like another element, another layer to the argument that you're making.
It's very funny, because when you said that, I suddenly thought, oh, maybe you mean male art. But in a very simple way, like sending out exhibition invitations, Jauniac folded that homage to Freud into four and posted it to everybody. I've actually even got one myself. He didn't post it to me. But the thing is, I think that I just said male art because it's flavour of the month as a term, on the one hand, but on the other hand, if it's actually going from Latin America to Poland, it's a miracle. If it's just going down the road in Saint-Germain-des-Prés, it's not really a miracle. And it wasn't a practice that somebody like Jauniac, working where he did, needed to apply as a concept to his own art. So it was really art for the male. But of course, that's not to say that the first interesting precursor piece of Paris-based male art is Yves Klein's blue stamps, which were again, you know, co-opting the whole of the post office to allow him to have blue monochrome stamps on envelopes for his invitation cards. So the idea that you can play with those supplementary pieces of the exhibition is important. So I left out a bit, but that was the essence of your question. So basically, there wasn't very much male art, but it was to do with. But I think that I'm not quite sure about the invitation card for the referendum, for example, which I think was a voting card, for example. So there are all sorts of very interesting things to do with supplements and additions and the paraphernalia of the exhibition that goes beyond the gallery that are indeed there.
I think we have time for one final question.
I'm sorry, this is the last question, because I'd like to open it out for the sort of what to do with the whole symposium. But I wonder, we've seemingly done for installation art a bit, and I wonder whether this symposium has managed to render the term conceptual completely impotent, because it now appears to include everything.
Who's that addressed to? Anyone in particular, or? Okay. Does anyone want to respond?
Well, I think my problem of not ever really studying conceptual art as I perhaps should have done with the same passion earlier, because now I feel I can invest my body and mind in it to a much greater extent, is precisely because of the exclusivity and the kind of ring fencing of that early stuff. Why it seems to me Morris is particularly interesting is because we saw in Seth Siegelab's presentation how he was in some of the classic early shows. He did some absolutely classic pieces, but he allowed himself to move through all sorts of different forms, performances himself and things, in a way that muddies the waters at the very, very beginning. So my question, which was about the South American thing where, you know, where cybernetics and, I mean, specific cybernetic exhibitions which were about cybernetics or specific psychoanalytic fora, I think that I am myself tormented by what is a permissible widening and what is an impermissible widening. But Boris said something very good yesterday about how, I can't remember the words, of course, but it was about how if it was just the narrow definition, A, we wouldn't all be here, but there would be very much less to talk about and think about and to play with intellectually. So the thing is, rather than feel cross, I think you should enjoy, which I say to my students as well. I mean, but there is a problem, and you can look at, I mean, it's a bibliographical and historiographical problem as well as a conversational problem today.
I think Daniel has one.
A very small point. A lot of artists really dislike the ascription conceptual art. I mean, Daniel Buren was tutting today saying, I hate this term, I always have. Lawrence Wiener is the same. And Alice Wiener once said that conceptual art would better serve the name of a fertility clinic than an artistic movement. That's my final point.
Well, I think that's exactly like the term feminism and feminist art. I mean, everybody basically wants to be an individual, let alone a great artist. However they fail or how they approximate is up to them.
I think on that point, we should probably thank Sarah and then move on to Boris, who will give the closing remarks. So thank you.
So as I was asked to give the closing remarks, I asked myself and also Sarah, you know, the formula is always a thank you in the name of, yeah? So I thought in the name of whom I can thank you and whom I can thank you because I do not represent any institutions. I thought that maybe in the name of participants, because we are at least participants. And looking at participants, it is clear that all these contributions cannot be summarized. And it's absolutely impossible to come to any consensus about any topics that were discussed yesterday or today. We have this case of extreme heteroglossia, yeah, we discussed earlier. Extreme heterogeneity of all the discourses, the semantics, and so on and so on. Also, we do not have, obviously, any consensus about the way of expansion of conceptual art and what is conceptual, what is not. I would suggest to think that conceptualism is not a certain sum of objects, so that we say this work is conceptual and that work is not conceptual. It is also not a kind of list of artists. For example, Robert Moyes is conceptual, somebody else is not conceptual. I would say that there was a conceptualist moment. This conceptualist moment came together with minimalist moment, with political moment, and you have some intersections, but you have some divergences and heterogeneities. And for example, even some cases I would recognize conceptual moment in Robert Morris, in some other cases, I would recognize completely different attitudes or influence on completely different attitudes. And I would also recognize, for example, pop art influences. I would recognize Surrealist influences, yes, that's also very strong. We should not forget that line in contemporary art, post-surrealist art. So it's a complicated matter, and speaking about conceptualism, we should not define it in any way that would be a list of work, a list of artists. And so I believe that we indeed, all these heterogeneous references and discourses built at the same time a certain network based more on contradictions and network of problems and network of oppositions, more that network of mutual maybe understanding or consensus, but we can move inside this network. And I think we did that in a very agreeable and productive manner. So in the name of participants, I would like to thank both institutions, Curto Institute of Art and Tate Modern, specifically Sarah and Gabriela and Nick, who made a very incredible job to organize this very complicated conference. And I also would thank audience for endurance and perseverance through all these heterogeneous matters and attitudes. Thank you.